from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama addressed the nation last night from the Oval Office.
The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it. We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us.
He spoke to a nation on edge following the mass shooting in San Bernardino. The massacre is being investigated as a terror attack. We are learning more about the husband and wife killers and what may have put them on what the president called the dark path to radicalization. So, who radicalized whom? How did they fly under the radar? What more did they have planned? We know this, it was quiet and ultimately deadly. This hour on Point, San Bernardino and the challenge of ISIS-inspired terrorism. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the president reassure you last night? How should the country deal with this? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The terrorist threat, said the president, has evolved.
The terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino.
It's being called DIY, do-it-yourself, jihad, or maybe self-radicalization. Here's the president talking about the dark path he described.
It is clear that the two of them had gone down the dark path of radicalization, embracing a perverted interpretation of Islam that calls for war against America and the West. They had stockpiled assault weapons, ammunition, and pipe bombs. So this was an act of terrorism designed to kill innocent people.
Who knew? Who could have? Should have known? Even Saeed Farouk, the husband's sister, said she had no idea with CBS on Thursday.
So many things I asked myself. I asked myself if I had called him that morning or the night before, asked him how he was doing, what he was up to. If I had any inclination, maybe I could have stopped it.
We're going to begin today in San Bernardino. Over the weekend, FBI agents raided the home of a man believed to have purchased two military-grade rifles used in the attacks. Joining us with all the latest is Abby Phillip of The Washington Post. Abby, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What have we learned in the last 2-3 days about these two, Saeed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, his wife?
The most information we've gotten has been about Malik, Tashfeen Malik, who grew up in both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And we're hearing from her family over there that she, at some point in recent years, had become more conservative, more devout, more focused on modesty and that sort of thing. And she also distanced herself from her family, and they noticed a change in her several years ago. Fast forward to 2014, when she reportedly married this man who, similarly, his family and friends say that he recently had become much more conservative, much more stringent in the practice of his faith, especially compared to the rest of his family. And these two met, and they came over to the United States, and a lot of people who know them and know the shooters, Saeed Farouk, say that he really closed himself off from people who were close to him once she arrived in the United States. And that's, you know, that's about as much as we know, because at that point, his family members and his friends say, you know, we really didn't know much about him. They were very private people. She wasn't allowed to be in the room with other men. She kept to herself. Her entire face was covered except for her eyes. So there's very little that people feel like they know concretely about this couple, especially in the last year.
People were being so careful last week that this might have been initially sparked by some unhappiness in the workplace there in San Bernardino. But then on Friday, we suddenly had news of this Facebook posting by the wife, Tashfeen Malik, pledging allegiance to the Islamic State. How was that found? What happened with that?
Well, it turns out that right as the attacks were happening, Facebook and the names of the shooters emerged. Facebook did a search on their own site and found what they believed to be a profile associated with these people. They took them down and alerted officials. But around that time, around 11 a.m. Pacific time, when the shooting happened, Tashfeen Malik, reportedly under an alias, pledged allegiance to the ISIS leader. Now, you know, there are a lot of puzzling things about this case, as the FBI director, James Comey, said on Friday. And one of them is that there is some indication that there was conversation in the workplace that upset the Saeed Farouk. His father, over the weekend, told reporters that that he was upset about something, that a conversation about Israel that he had had with a coworker at work. On the other hand, the arsenal that this couple amassed in their home, the pre-planning, the practice, indicates that this was not a crime necessarily of opportunity or a terror attack necessarily limited to this workplace. They were planning well in advance, and it shows all the hallmarks of terrorism that may be motivated by self-radicalization.
6,000 rounds of ammunition, a dozen pipe bombs. Is there any further thought on whether they were headed when they were intercepted and ultimately killed last week, whether they were headed to do more shooting, bombing?
Well, that's a big question for law enforcement. They are desperately trying to find out. Remember, after the shooting happened, they left that conference room, and they were missing for 4 hours before law enforcement eventually caught up with them.
Through a neighbor's tip, right, Abby?
Exactly. They saw this black van that police said they were looking for. They saw the black van. Police went there. And when they intercepted the couple, it turned into a massive shootout. But for 4 hours, we don't know where they went, where they were going, what they were planning, what they were preparing for. That's a critical question for law enforcement right now, because it certainly does seem that what they did in that conference room was not as much as they could have done. Many people said that given how armed they were, they could have done far more damage than they eventually did.
Who knows? Were they saving themselves for another attack or just decided to get out of there? What about the man who apparently helped acquired and got these assault-style rifles to them, Enrique Marquez, a Walmart security guard? Who is he?
Enrique Marquez is the next-door neighbor of Saeed Farouk when he once lived in a house in Riverside, California here. The houses are really feet away from each other. Neighbors in that community say that the two men shared a common interest in cars. They would work on cars in their garage. But Marquez, like Farouk, was seen as sort of an enigma, and many people didn't know him. Some people described him as a little bit unfriendly, but we don't know exactly what connection he has to this investigation beyond the fact that he purchased the two rifles that were used in the attack. This man has now checked himself into a mental health facility where he has remained, and it sounds like law enforcement has not been able, at least yesterday, they were not able to question him because he's being treated in a healthcare facility.
He doesn't so far look exactly like an Islamic State connection. This allegiance to al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State, that she apparently posted this bayat, I think it's called in Arabic, oath of allegiance. This has been done before, right, in the attacks in Garland, Texas earlier this year. One of the guys tweeted an oath like this on his way to the attack site in Texas, Garland.
Right, and, you know, it signals that there was an awareness and perhaps a desire to associate themselves with ISIS, but that is quite different from ISIS directing an attack like they did in Paris or perhaps with the Russian airliner that was downed over Egypt. You know, they have demonstrated, the Islamic State has demonstrated an ability to direct attacks beyond the Middle East, to have control over them, perhaps financing them as well. In this case, it does not quite seem like they had those kinds of connections. Law enforcement officials have said that Saeed Farouk had telephonic contact with people who they are aware of, who are parts of open investigations. But the connections, they've also said, were fairly minor, that they weren't enough to sort of warrant any heightened concern or surveillance on this couple. So it sounds like perhaps they attempted to make contact, but ISIS, even in their statement acknowledging these attacks, didn't say that they had directed them, and they certainly didn't say that that they claimed responsibility. They said that the attacks were carried out by supporters, and that's an acknowledgement that this couple, they were not part of an inner circle or you know, a centralized planning that that ISIS had directed. They were perhaps just acting on their own and sending a signal that this was done in the name of this cause by ISIS.
I'm reading here that in the English language broadcast from ISIS, they said soldiers of the caliphate, which has been used by those who have been directed. But in the Arabic version, as you say, it just said supporters, a different thing. But no hard evidence at this point. What about the financing? I mean, these weren't highly paid people, and it wasn't a lot of money involved here, but these guns and ammo, they're not free.
They're not, and the rifles in particular are not cheap. they cost over $1,000. They were outfitted in ways that were intended to make them more lethal, and showed signs that they had been researching ways to sort of outfit them in a more militaristic style, making the two guns interchangeable so that either shooter could use them. There were signs that they invested a significant amount of money into this effort. And, you know, I mean, given that this couple lived in a very small apartment here, he actually made a decent amount of money, but he was supporting a wife and a child, a wife who, mind you, did not work because she chose not to. It suggests that they devoted a portion of what they had as a family to building this arsenal. And it's really an open question where the money came from. And I don't know any more than you do at this point. We haven't heard much from law enforcement on that front.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the terror in San Bernardino last week, what we're really learning about the husband and wife, apparently at the heart of the killing and the challenge ahead in taking on homegrown, perhaps ISIS-inspired, terrorism. You can join us this hour. Is this it? Is this homegrown terrorism spontaneously rising to support ISIS, or does it look more complicated? A bride from Pakistan with time in Saudi Arabia, a young man traveling, coming home, changed, maybe? What explains the ferocity of this, the heaps of ammo and guns and bombs and death? Abby Phillip is with us with the Washington Post in San Bernardino, where she's been reporting on all this. A lot of reaction over the weekend. Democrat, Republican, neighbors. Here was Hillary Clinton with George Stephanopoulos on ABC saying battle not being won yet.
Now we have to turn our attention to the very sophisticated propagation of this new threat from ISIS.
So we're not winning that battle yet.
Well, we're not winning, but it's too soon to say that we are doing everything we need to do. And I've outlined very clearly.
So if you
know
what
we have to fight them in the air, we have to fight them on ground, and we have to fight them on the internet.
There's Hillary Clinton's formula: in the air, on the ground, on the internet. A kind of new twist on Churchill there. Donald Trump, they're animals. Talking with CBS Face the Nation.
I think the press is making it, they're glamorizing these people. These people are animals. These people are not masterminds. They're not even smart people. I bet you they have very low IQs. We have to stop their internet work. They're doing better at the, we came up with the internet, but they're using it better than we do.
And regular people just trying to figure out what's going on. San Bernardino resident correctional counselor Elvira Harris watched the president's speech last night, talked with KBCR, said people need to be vigilant.
What disturbed me is when people didn't want to report what they thought was suspicious because they didn't want to be accused of profiling. We can't be afraid like that. That's how things like this happen. Because when it doesn't make sense to you, it probably really doesn't make sense.
Abby Phillip in San Bernardino, where people have gone back to work today after being away from work last week. Please stand by there. With me in the studio right now, J.M. Berger, research analyst and writer, fellow at the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror with Jessica Stern. J.M. Berger, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Seamus Hughes joins us, deputy director of the program on extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, George Washington University, co-author of the really interesting new report, ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. I highly recommend it. Seamus Hughes, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Seamus, what have you learned in what Abby's describing, what we've all seen and read in the last 3 or 4 days?
Yeah, so we looked over a six-month period, we looked at 71 cases of people that are in the legal system for ISIS-related charges. And the profile of the individuals in San Bernardino kind of matches the profile of what we looked at, which is to say that there is not necessarily a profile. There's a diversity of the threat. So the average age is 26, so they generally fall in that category. But one-third of the cases of people in the legal system are 21 years or younger. They tend to be male, but we saw a number of women that were involved in terrorism in the last 10 cases in the last year. So it's an interesting dynamic. And what is novel about this is her role as a mass shooter. We haven't seen that in the homeland in the past.
Do you see ISIS-inspired terrorism here, Jamberger?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's the question that really this sort of comes down to in terms of what's going on broadly is inspired versus networked. And so when we talk about inspired, there's an idea of this kind of lone wolf who just pops up and does something. And when you talk about networked, that means that they're in some kind of contact with ISIS even though they're not being given directions. Mm-hmm. The thing in this case that's really kind of the wild card that throws everything into question is their choice of target. It's extremely unusual for a terrorist attack to target people you know, coworkers, family like that. And it's extremely unusual for people to kill coworkers or family before carrying out another terrorist attack. So to me, that's a big point of ambiguity in this.
Seamus, how do you read that? I mean, everyone's trying to sort of take the temperature of our own country now and think, do we have a volatile vein of ISIS-sympathetic folks in the country who would be ready to carry out attacks like this? And as Jamberger says, the wrinkle here is that this isn't a sort of standard attack where you'd go to the old fear was a shopping mall or anonymous targets. These were people that certainly Saeed knew very, very well, including at least one Muslim woman there, I think, who went to the same mosque as him. What do you make of that, Seamus?
Yeah, a couple things. I think it's important to put this in context in terms of, 71 people in the legal system for ISIS-related charges is statistically small when you look at the larger population, both of Muslim Americans and then Americans writ large. The question then becomes, and we saw it in the last few weeks.
Could you define what you mean by that 71, Seamus? What are you talking about there?
Sure. So 71 people in the legal system in the last 2 years have been charged with ISIS-related charges. And by that I mean material support to terrorism, false statements, attempt to travel to go to Syria and Iraq. And the vast majority were trying to travel over to join the so-called caliphate. What I think is interesting, and JM and I may discuss this a little bit more, is we saw in the last few weeks, especially online, a number of people saying, number of ISIS recruiters in Syria and Iraq saying, don't come over here. It's too hard now. It's too hard to get through customs at Turkey. There's too many roadblocks. Do what you can where you can. So the question then becomes whether we're going to see necessarily a shift in the homegrown violent extremists, whether they, refocus their efforts away from travel and more towards the homeland.
And when they say do what you can where you can, we're not talking fundraising exactly here. I mean, they're saying explicitly pick up anything at your disposal and attack somebody.
Exactly.
Abby, at this point, how are you reading the reports from law enforcement and investigators here on who was the prime mover, him or her, Saeed or Tashfeen?
Well, there's a lot of attention being paid to Tashfeen, partly because she was most recently and for the most extended period of time in the region where we don't know what might have happened to her.
And not just in Pakistan, where there are certainly radicalized folks, but in Saudi Arabia a lot as well, where the religion can be very conservative.
Right. And we also, we've had conflicting reports from the Saudi government and the Pakistani government about her actual whereabouts in those two places. So from law enforcement's perspective, there's a huge question mark when we are trying to look back at where was she, who did she associate with, what did she do? There are large swaths of time where I think we don't quite know and they don't quite know. By contrast, I think it's largely established that Saeed Farouk spent the majority of the time here in the United States. Most people who saw him here saw him fairly regularly. So that's why Tashfeen has become a little bit more of the center point of inquiry. She is an enigma. She became an enigma to people here once she was in the United States. It was very clear that she made very little attempt to assimilate herself into his family or into his community here. People at the mosques that he attended say they rarely, if ever, saw her. She rarely left her home, and she rarely spoke. And so I think the mystery that surrounds her are really just questions that need to be answered about what she was up to before she came to the United States, and what role did she play in changing this man that a lot of people described as gentle and frankly kind into someone who could carry out a really horrific and violent terror attack.
We're going to look more closely at that. Abby Phillip in San Bernardino with the Washington Post. You're generous with your time today, and we're grateful for it. Thanks a lot for joining us for a minute here, Abby.
Thank you.
I want to begin to bring our callers in. Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi.
Hi.
Listen, on the one thing with Hillary Clinton, I find it really rather absurd when she talks about, like, the propagation of radicalization when, you know, I know they have to deal with the immediate threat of terrorism and how critical that is. However, when we look at our history, you know, Hillary's vote for the 2002 war, you know, that authorization, and then her pushes in the State Department for military intervention in Libya created a catastrophe. You know, some arming rebels in Syria that we didn't know who they were, which opened the door for ISIS, which ISIL, they talk about it being...
So what are you saying, Kathleen? You're blaming San Bernardino on Hillary Clinton?
No, not at all. But that we have to look at our own history of cultivating radicalization. Like, I mean, the disbanding of the Iraqi army is totally linked into the birth of ISIS. And now ISIS is in Syria. We're arming rebels. So, of course, we've got to look at, and I was looking the other day. First of all, I recommend people read the 9/11 Commission report and what the summary.
Kathleen, cut to the chase. We're not going all the way back to that right now. Do you have a question here?
Well, yeah, my question is, don't we need to look at our own history in cultivating radicalization?
I'll take it to our panel. I appreciate your call, Jan Berger.
Certainly, a lot of the policy choices we've made over the last 10 years have created a space in which radicalism can grow. So when we have taken out decapitated dictatorships, that such as in Libya, such as in Iraq, but we haven't had a structure to rise up in their place, or we've had unrealistic expectations about what kind of political structure will rise up in their place. So, you know, we've opened those spaces. I mean, the extremists are responsible for what they do. They are the ones who are filling this void, but we gave them room to operate, and that's something we need to think about.
But Seamus, still the ferocity of if this is blowback or call it what you will, just the ferocity of it in Saeed Farouk's case, in Tashfeen Malik's case. As you say, this is unusual for a young woman who's a mother to be involved in something like this, go literally ballistic here. You know, they're there with the assault-style rifles on their hip, just firing and firing and firing. And then again, out of the SUV on the highway, how do you conceive of the mindset, the motivation in each of these people, a young woman in particular, Seamus, that goes off like that?
Yeah, I think it's also important to remember that we've seen type of mass shootings before in 2009 at Fort Hood, but also the attempted attack in Garland. What's interesting here is also the pipe bombs and the amount of pipe bombs.
More attacks were imagined.
Absolutely. So each person is different in how they get down this radicalization. I won't say path because it's not a linear process. People move in and out of it, and it's highly individualized. But what you see is essentially you become part of an echo chamber where you only want to hear what you want to hear. The news that you listen to is only going to fit your worldview. And I would posit an opinion that it's entirely possible these two fed off each other, and it's not necessarily a one-way street. I've seen a lot of news reports about the role of the wife in this thing, but I would imagine it's actually a little bit more parody when it comes to that.
Even so, JM, feeding off one another, it's almost, I don't know if it's necessary, but to bring it to a fever pitch, where you are putting together an arsenal in your garage, where you're working late at night on cutting pipe and making pipe bombs. And you're, if they're not part of a network, then they're really putting some study into figuring out how to do this. It's not just dead obvious how to wire up these bombs and how to modify the guns and all the rest. Speak to that motivation. If that's what the president's talking about, the poison that's come from ISIS into this country, speak of the strength of it, the ferocity of what that is eliciting here.
Well, I think it's easy to underestimate the power of having somebody standing next to you who believes the same thing that you do, who sees the world in the same thing that you do. And when you have that affirmation from a social group, whether it's just a spouse or a partner or whether it's online community, that is a powerful thing. When you have feelings about what's going on in the world and you feel strongly about it, social affirmation is a big part of what will move you to act. And
could it be a party of two with all that much social affirmation? We're told that the mosque he was attending was not a radical mosque.
It can be a party of two. I mean, that's what the Boston Marathon bombing looked like. Mm-hmm. Two guys, brothers, family, close relationship, reinforcing each other's resolve, reinforcing each other's intention to act. Now, the fact that they went to such pains to destroy their phones, to erase their digital footprint, suggests that they had other social contact as well. I mean, I'm not saying that it's necessarily all in the family in this case.
Seamus, what about that? That effort to crush and destroy the digital evidence, a marker to you that there would have been potentially interaction here they wanted to cover up?
Yeah, I think it's entirely possible. And you see it essentially twofold. One is they try to destroy their media. And I think JM's right, in order to prevent people from being able to trace the network, if there is one. But in general, attackers like this don't necessarily care if people know who they are. So I think that's important why they destroyed their phone versus why they didn't destroy anything that was in their apartments or other things like that. It's the phone had the essentially the contacts and the network, so you'll be able to see if that actually shakes out.
Might we still see that reconstructed, or the fact that we haven't heard so far means that it could be learn something and going after it?
Yeah. So the FBI has essentially bagged everything and flown it to Washington. And there's a team in Virginia that goes through this, what we call media exploitation, and sees where it is. That takes a long time. And even if you have a team of people, and they have a team of people doing this now, it's just very painstaking to try to recreate this.
Dennis in Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin. Dennis, you're on the air.
Okay. You've been talking about this issue as if there's some single little cause, possibly from terrorist influence, on the couple. But there's a broader viewpoint to look at it. Maybe you can see it as a problem of enculturation and personal identity. And that problem is faced most by the children of the immigrants to any country, and especially to ours, if they're coming from a very alien kind of culture, such as an Asian culture or a Middle Eastern culture. And the parents are happy to be here, and they still have their old culture, but the children who have that old culture at home are having to fend their way in a alien kind of world, and they are suffering a loss in that process of any sort of identity, of any sort of culture.
Dennis, we've got it. On the other hand, Jim Berger, generation after generation of Americans have made that migration. And it's not easy, but it's been done again and again and again. Does having ISIS standing out there make that much difference in that process?
It's complicated. I mean, there is definitely a component of identity in what ISIS does. In fact, that's probably the overwhelmingly important part of identity. But at the same time, we see this kind of identity-based extremism all over the place. It's not just immigrants. It's not just Muslims. I mean, we have, you see a lot of similar characteristics in white supremacy, for instance. I'm very interested in sort of doing comparative looks at how extremism functions, because I think that, there's something that's kind of universal across all the different ideologies.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the terror in San Bernardino, what we're really learning about the husband and wife at the heart of the killing, and the challenge ahead in taking on homegrown, ISIS-inspired terrorism. Seamus Hughes is with us. He was with the National Counterterrorism Center. Now he's at George Washington University, co-author of the big new report, ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa. It's pretty compelling. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And J.M. Berger is with us with the Brookings Institution, co-author with Jessica Stern of ISIS, The State of Terror. You can join us as well. How do we get smarter, more clear-eyed about what's going on, and what is the way through this? Here was U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, saying that looking at whether there was a larger plot or network here, but so far, no evidence.
Obviously, we have concerns whenever we see people who have large stockpiles of weapons or appear to be in the process of accumulating weapons and ammunition. At this point, we do not have any evidence that they were part of either a larger group or a cell.
But stand by. They've taken a lot back to Washington. They're paying attention to it now. FBI LA Assistant Director David Bowditch, press conference on Friday, saying they're on it.
There are some telephonic connections between these two individuals, at least one of these individuals, and other subjects of our investigation.
And last night, the president saying whether you can find direct connections or not, there's a poison that moves here, whether it's the Boston Marathon bombers or the San Bernardino killers.
As groups like ISIL grew stronger amidst the chaos of war in Iraq and then Syria, and as the internet erases the distance between countries, we see growing efforts by terrorists to poison the minds of people like the Boston Marathon bombers and the San Bernardino killers.
So we heard Hillary Clinton there, J.M. Berger, saying we got to fight them on the, you know, in the air and fight them on the land and fight them on the internet. Is the power that great? This, call it propaganda or outreach or just social networking, is it that great?
It is, but I think that we talk too much about trying to counter their message and kind of to counter their narrative. I mean, I think that something that's happening that the internet is enabling and social media especially is that people who have fringe views, people who are extremists, who are inclined to violence, can seek each other out in ways that they were never able to do before. You can talk to somebody who has a violent ideology without putting yourself at risk. You don't have to be around a dangerous person to hear about their ideology. You can find people who share even, you know, the most exotic kind of ideas online very quickly. And I think that this is, you know, part of a wider social reordering that we're probably going to be dealing with for some years and not just in extremism and terrorism.
Seamus, you did a whole report on this, and I wish you'd share some of your findings with us. I mean, the way this moves kind of like a virus. I'm looking at CNN reporting as we speak that in, you know, the knife attacker on the tube, the subway in London, apparently on his cell phone, he had pictures of the San Bernardino scene. A kind of contagion maybe right there. I'm also seeing the Times of London reporting, everybody's in San Bernardino these days, that Tashfeen Malik, the wife, fired the first shots, they're now reporting, in the San Bernardino massacre while her husband appeared to hesitate. That's pretty fired up. What about the power of what people see online and what you learned in your in-depth study on ISIS in America?
Yeah, I tend to agree with JM that we put a lot of emphasis on social media, and I'll go through that a little bit too. But relationships do matter too. We've seen a number of cases, both in Minneapolis and St. Louis, where in-person or physical world relationships was essentially the driver. That's not to say that social media isn't important. And let's talk a little bit about how ISIS uses the social media environment. It's essentially threefold. The first way is they groom recruits. So they see somebody that's naive, and then essentially ISIS spotters slowly bring them into the fold, slowly introducing the narrative into it. The second way they do it essentially is act as travel agents or provide logistical support. So if you're a kid from Chicago and you want to, you know, figure out a way to get to Syria, you can reach out to people online over a series of courses of weeks and months. You build a level of trust and then get phone numbers of people to call when you land so you're able to cross the border. And then the third way in which we saw this in Garland is essentially the devil on the shoulder. So it's the people, what the FBI terms as the devil on the shoulder. It's people online egging others to go, you know, commit a violent act. So it runs the spectrum on that. And again, I've talked previously a little bit about the echo chamber, but I think it's a fair assessment. It's what the Assistant Attorney General kind of called it. It's an online community similar to what you would have, you know, on Reddit or places like that, mm-hmm. Where everyone kind of knows each other. You're able to kind of share, you know, inside jokes and comedic memes, and there's a level of trust that's kind of built in through there.
Glenna in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Glenna, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
This looks like a setup to me. He went online looking for love in the Middle East. They picked up on him as a mama's boy. She was an operative, trained. She went over after they married in Saudi Arabia, and he went on with his life, but he succumbed to her, and it was a marriage of convenience for the ICE.
Glenna, we've got it. There's a theory of the case, deliberate plant, naive American boy, ready to rock, Pakistani girl. What do you say, Jam?
Well, I think that's – we can't rule it out yet, but I think that's one of the least likely explanations for
why?
This. It's
'cause I'm sure many other people's minds have floated in that direction.
When these guys were getting together and meeting each other, there was no ISIS. So this was a couple of years ago that they met.
I mean, there was, but it was very, very early nascent days.
Not in its current form.
Yeah.
These kinds of things do happen, but we don't see sleeper cells like on 24 that often. It's extraordinarily rare. I think that one thing that does come up in this discussion a lot is the idea of matrimony, and that is something we do see ISIS recruiters do kind of stalk Lonely Hearts kind of sites. Mm-hmm. They stalk places where Muslims go to try and make connections because lonely people are vulnerable people, and that's an opening. That could have applied to either of them, but there hasn't been a case, you know, like this kind of ISIS Matahari thing. We haven't seen anything like that.
Seamus, how about it? People are saying not networked, not connected, but what if the connection is staring us right in the face? I mean, she came over. She is reportedly a very enthusiastic participant. Connection.
Yeah, I would hesitate to go down that path. Looking at these things, we tend to think that there's another there. But, we've seen the cases of people that are homegrown radical. It doesn't seem to essentially be, you know, a sleeper or things like that. So, you know, I share JM's view that it's much more likely that, they got together and then perhaps, you know, radicalized each other or so on and so forth.
Wow. Abdullah in Meriden, Connecticut. Abdullah, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks. What do you see?
I just want to make a very quick remark here as a statement. We're trying to find out what make people snap and actually try to retaliate to something they feel that they've been oppressed, something that they've been wronged. It's very simple. You know, we can't put Band-Aids on things. People that are Muslims, I'm a Muslim here.
Okay.
I immigrated, and my children are here.
Yeah.
They're first generation. So I'll tell you exactly what it is, so we can go straight to the source.
Please.
People are hard to find a mate, so they go online. It's a common thing. It's not a successful thing to do, but, you know, it's one of the ways. But it doesn't have anything to do with anything. I'll tell you exactly what the problem is. The problem is we're humans. Whomever says that the brain controls the body is wrong, because it does to a certain extent. But when emotion overflows, the body becomes a wimp. I mean, the brain becomes a wimp. Emotion, when people watch on Al Jazeera, or Al Mayadeen. This is what most of the Muslims do. They have different cultures. They're not all Arabs, as a matter of fact.
You're talking about watching television originating out of the Middle East, and what would they see, Abdullah, that might upset people?
You know, you see bombs, and especially when they start, you know, they're educated, they start analyzing things, and they listen to, for example, General Clark saying that, the memo when Rumsfeld was still in, that the plan was 7 countries in 5 years. And they see that there is an agenda for them. And they see all those pictures of people dead.
Yeah, but a lot of people are being killed by Daesh or ISIS itself, Abdullah. Beheaded.
I'm sorry?
A lot of people, Muslims included, very much included, right at the heart of the killing, in fact, are being killed by ISIS.
I'm with you 100%. ISIS is going to be eliminated very soon anyway. Everybody's going to turn against it. It's a fact. It's going to happen. Nobody knows the future. But I'm telling you about what makes people snap here, whether they belong to a group or they don't belong to another group.
Yeah.
It's the fact that they feel oppressed. They feel like there's an agenda against them, and they see those gruesome pictures on different channels. Because that's what they watch, especially when they're back.
Yeah, Abdullah, we've got it. I'm a little confused because a lot of what people see lately, and I know there's violence in all kinds of places. The Iraq War, a lot of people died. You've got Israel and the Palestinians. There's a lot of violence that comes out of that. But ISIS has been right up front lately in terms of the most theatrical, dramatic, gruesome killing. Seamus, what about for Muslim Americans whose families have roots in the Middle East and the news and images that have come out of there, do you see that as a line to the snap?
We've seen that ISIS's main target and victims are fellow Muslims. So we've seen the vast majority of victims being Muslim. In terms of what drives people to join things, in early on, about a year and a half ago when we started looking at the first early cases, a lot of the driver was the Assad atrocities. You saw the barrel bombs and the cluster bombs and the horrible images that we all saw of young people being killed by Assad. And that was a driver, a sense of wanting to do something. The international community wasn't kind of helping on it. I think we've seen a shift in terms of the drivers of people, at least the ones that want to go to Syria and Iraq. It's much more about the so-called state, the fact that you can actually go to somewhere like that. And we've seen examples of that. But again, each person's different and the grievances are depending on the person. And just, people by their very nature are complex. So it's kind of hard to point to this one example of, this is why people decide to join.
From your big report, ISIS in America, what's your assessment? Are we sitting on top of a volcano here of lots of deeply unhappy Muslim Americans who feel marginalized and are open to the ISIS appeal? Or is this a tiny fringe? You say the number is not large. It's been arrested within the population. Characterize what you see there, Seamus.
Yeah, I think it's very fair to say it's a very tiny fringe. The FBI says they have 900 active investigations related to ISIS. So if you just do by population size, you're talking about a very small fringe. But you have a larger question here, and that is, what do you do on the front end?
Where's the front end? What do you mean?
The front end, what I mean by that is if you have a loved one that you believe is radicalized into violence, there's not necessarily any programs both in the federal and state or local level of what you can do. Short of telling the FBI and watching your loved one, possibly get arrested for material support to terrorism. We haven't cracked that nut. And our European partners have because they've had to because of the numbers. So we have 250 Americans that have traveled to Syria and Iraq or at least attempted to. The French have 1,200. You just can't arrest your way out of that. And we haven't figured that out, at least domestically. What's the alternative? What's the middle way from this? There's always going to be a subset of people that you should arrest and put away for life. But there's also a subset of people that are reachable before they cross that legal threshold.
That is interesting. I want to look at that. Matthew in Norman, Oklahoma. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So basically, just to sum it up, whenever I was in Iraq training the Iraqi military, they would bring up good points that a lot of things that happen in the U.S., like the, anti-Muslim language some people use in the U.S., makes it very easy for moderate Muslims to turn into extremists or turn to extremist groups whenever they look around them in the U.S. and feel like they're in a hostile environment towards Muslims. So my question would be, what could we do to take the fuel out of the fire of their ideology rather than turning to a stance of combating them more aggressively?
I appreciate your question, Matthew. Jan Berger, how about it? Seamus says we need some kind of front end of a softer intervention that is not necessarily going straight to the FBI. You can see why someone might be slightly hesitant to call in the government if it's going to mean, a neighbor goes to the slammer when they're just, reading and interested. On the other hand, you hear the question from our caller, how do you take the fuel out of this?
Well, we're seeing at this point, I think, a really ugly wave of anti-Muslim sentiment that we didn't even really see at 9/11. And, you know, I think it's being stoked by the presidential election. And the presidential election also puts us in stasis as far as what's going to happen next. Who gets elected president mm-hmm. next is going to affect the shape of the programs that are going to allow us to try and get out ahead of this and provide alternatives to art incarceration. So if it's a Donald Trump presidency, there are going to be no alternatives to incarceration. If it's a Hillary Clinton presidency, we might see that. In the middle of this very heated campaign, it's a very difficult time. And I think that that hostile environment does, you know, I don't think it necessarily makes moderates more likely to turn to extremism, but it makes it more difficult for moderates to talk to authorities, to talk to their neighbors, to really, you know, to do the things that will help us get out ahead of this and sort of see a case when it's coming in its early stages.
Seamus, it may be that we've needed a more candid, full conversation about this. On the other hand, the vitriolic language toward Muslims that has come out of some quarters is really hot. I mean, I remember President George W. Bush. He took us into Iraq, but he was so, so buttoned up and careful to maintain respectful language toward Muslim Americans. How big a deal is this rhetorical change, Seamus?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal, and the fact that you're feeding into what essentially is ISIS's narrative of us versus them is important. And I agree with JM that we haven't figured out a level of nuance on this to say that the issue isn't Islam, it's the Islamist ideology, and there's a distinct difference.
Yes,
the problem is you can't have that conversation right now, both in the public sphere and things like that. So I would argue that we need to get to that point. We're just nowhere near that now.
What a rough moment for Americans to be cut off from that kind of strong nuance needed to cut through to accuracy and truth here. We'll just have to deal with it. Seamus Hughes, we're really grateful to you for being with us today from George Washington University. Thank you for all your work, your report, ISIS in America. Link to it, listeners, at our website, onpointradio.org. Seamus, thank you.
Thank you.
And J.M. Berger, co-author with Jessica Stern of ISIS, The State of Terror, out of the Brookings Institution. J.M., thanks for coming in today. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.